Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdropper. On today's show, this is our 100th episode. So, wow, we're going to spend the first part of the show congratulating ourselves. Eventually, we'll get to the aftermath of the net neutrality decision, which, of course, happened while both myself and Baron were away, because the FCC intentionally did that to screw us over. But, Baron, welcome back. You've been away from DC for a long time, and we've missed you a lot. Did you miss me?
24 days, and no. So not really.
Are you saying you didn't miss DC, or that you didn't miss me, or you didn't miss either of us?
Yes.
Yes.
It was a very good trip.
So
I can't say that I'm thrilled to be back, but here we are.
Are you going to move there forever? Or
yes.
Yes? Okay. So this is you're shutting down Tech Freedom on the episode today?
No.
That's our big news?
No, you'll figure it out.
So before we get into the wonderful world of the net neutrality decision, tell us a little bit about Europe.
Well, the plumbing sucks, but the food is great and generally awesome.
And do you notice a distinct difference between the way that Europeans approach technology policy as opposed to your very eccentric American self?
Yeah, to put it mildly. So I started in Brussels for the Eurodig, which is the Internet Governance Forum. It's a regional meeting. We have the European Governance Forum, the Internet Governance Forum, excuse me, coming up in DC on July 14th. In Europe, it happens in early June every year. It's a neat event. You get people from all over Europe who come together to talk about internet policy, and you get a great expression of how they think about things, just as you would if you went to the IGF here or to any other regional meeting. For example, the very first thing that someone said to me as I was at the reception, he hadn't seen me in a long time, and he says, "Oh, Baron, but what are you doing here? You're an American." So there were not a lot of Americans there, which in a way was good. It's nice to be an outsider and for example, to tell people what really went on in the court decision about net neutrality, what the FCC had actually said. One thing that generally strikes me is, and I'm sure this happens here too, it's very easy for people to talk about something like, "Oh, well, as the FCC said about this topic," without really having the full context. There were people who were trying to use the Open Internet Order to their advantage and claiming that the FCC had said all sorts of really negative things about zero rating, about giving away free data service, when in fact that the FCC did say some of those things, but they also tried to be even-handed and noted there could be benefits and declined to take a clear position.
And that shows something that we've talked about on the show before, where what the United States decides to do on technology policy obviously has an outsized impact on the world because of Silicon Valley and because the internet was born here. And of course, it's very opportunistic and easy for Europeans when they see the United States take an aggressive regulatory approach or do something that comports with a European technocratic worldview. They'll pounce on it and say that it's kind of like a validation of their approach. Whereas if we did something they didn't support or was too free market, they'd probably say, "Well, we're Europe and they're the United States and we can be different." Either way, it's a win for them.
Yeah, the way I would put it is, and I'm sure this is true going the opposite direction as well. Number one, anytime you have this kind of influence of one country's policy discussion on another, it's a game of telephone. So what you're getting in that country is going to be a filtered version of what actually happened by people who probably haven't really been paying attention. Something we're very conscious of whenever we talk about foreign policy issues. We don't have all the context, and we need to be careful not to suggest that we totally get what they're talking about. But the second is, and this is also true for us, you're going to have a high degree of confirmation bias. So people are going to talk about the part of what happened in the other country that seems to agree with them. And they're going to play that up and ignore the rest of it. It's just a lot easier to when you play that game of telephone, to filter through and get the parts that you want. And then, of course, then there's the added dimension of a certain resentment of the United States. I'll fast forward and say that at the end of my trip, which was in Helsinki for the ICANN meeting about internet governance, that's the nonprofit organization that regulates or coordinates the domain name system. The very first day was really eye-opening because we had a discussion about diversity at ICANN meetings, which was not only about gender diversity, which included the charming comment from someone on the floor that there were too many panelists with dangly bits between their legs, which then proceeded into a discussion about language diversity and cultural diversity, and climaxed with someone suggesting, a French person suggesting, that there was just too much of the Anglo-Saxon culture of debate and confrontation. And I'm not sure what the alternative was, but apparently those Enlightenment ideas, which, you know, like Voltaire, who was French, was pretty big on, are by some people seen as being really American and culturally chauvinistic and so on. And that, you know, that's real. That actually does play a part in the way that each side of the Atlantic hears each other and in the filtering that gets done of what people say about tech policy.
And maybe that's why American tech companies sometimes get accused by Europeans of being bullies. It might just be that they're clearly articulating their viewpoint passionately because they believe something. They believe that they shouldn't be regulated in this way, or that they shouldn't have to pay a $3 billion fine. And maybe it's jarring in a culture where you're supposed to intersperse a bunch of flowery rhetoric in with your, you know, declarative statements. And maybe they would find you off-putting, which I can't imagine why they would off-putting. But,
but that never happens in the U.S.
Well, that's what's good, yeah. So you were able to take your trade elsewhere. But did you find that you were ever in a room? I think I might have seen something to this effect on our Slack when you were kind of talking about your experiences over there, where you were the only one in the room who was American, and the topic of discussion was how to regulate American tech companies. Is there ever that disconnect where, like, no one even bothered to get someone who actually lives here
to give
their perspective?
And in particular, it's always in part, it's weird because it's about American companies. It's inspired by what the FCC has done or the Federal Trade Commission, but only the parts of it that fit with their preconceptions. And there isn't a lot of willingness to actually dig into the details of exactly how it's been done. And part of this that I think is really important and not easy for people to understand on the outside is, whether you like the U.S. approach or not, whether you're a libertarian or not, whatever your views are, at the end of the day, the U.S. system of dealing with these things is legalistic. Like, we have agencies that bring either enforcement actions or they issue regulations, and they go to great lengths to explain the legal rationale for what they're doing.
Even if it's complete bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, most of it is bullshit, as we say all the time.
But at least they tried.
That's right. They go through the exercise of doing that. They feel some sense of shame. We have things like the Administrative Procedure Act that require them to explain the basis for what they're doing, even if it is bullshit. In Europe, that doesn't really exist. I mean, in a way, it's like going back in time. In other words, the policymaking is really just that. It's policy. It doesn't really have a lot of analytical rigor to it. It's hard sometimes to put your finger on what the concern is. I mean, if you want to see what this looks like, go look at the Schrems decision. We've talked about that a few times on the show, about this is the European Court of Justice decision where they decided that the US-EU agreement for transferring data out of the European Union was not adequate to meet European privacy standards.
Yeah, basically for about 15 years, everyone assumed that data were protected from warrantless surveillance, and we all just kind of accepted that. And then Edward Snowden did his thing. So then someone was able to sue Facebook saying, well, clearly you can't be claiming that my data are protected from prying eyes when we know from the Snowden revelations that they aren't. So it basically struck down the agreement that allows the free flow of data to and from the Atlantic or across the EU and back. And Americans' data are often stored abroad. Europeans' data are stored in the United States. It's a seamless flow of information. It's kind of important. And that agreement was struck down. We've got this new thing called Privacy Shield. Basically, there's a real effort to ignore some of the underlying surveillance issues there.
Yeah, well, and that's precisely the point. The reason that the European Commission has been able to ignore the underlying issue, to strike a deal, a new deal, Privacy Shield, to replace the old deal, Safe Harbor, with the United States government, in a way that doesn't actually respond to what the court was talking about. The reason that that happened is that the decision is a mess. I mean, any American lawyer, even law student, who looks at that, it finds it bizarre, because it's not clear exactly what the legal standard is or how you satisfy it. And so in the end, you can have a response by the political actors that is just inherently political. And maybe they'll get away with it. Maybe the court will ultimately say, yeah, it's good enough. We know that the U.S. system hasn't really changed that much. It's still pretty unpleasant from a European perspective about privacy. And this deal, because it focuses entirely on how private companies use data, doesn't actually solve the problem we were concerned with last time, which was government surveillance. But we don't actually know, because it's not legal in the way that we think of the rule of law working. It's very much, it's like an ongoing fluid process of negotiating policy.
Yeah, and this is actually a nice segue to Brexit. But before we get there, this mess of incentives really illustrates how crazy this issue is and how the differences between cultures play into it. So you have Germany, a country that has a history with the Stasi that makes them very skeptical of government surveillance, and they care a lot about that. Whereas you have people in the United Kingdom who rely on the common law, and they basically, surveillance is a fact of life. There's CCTV all over London. They don't really care as much. And then there's Americans. Maybe we're somewhere in between. But really, the decision to strike down data flows across the Atlantic, that was about government surveillance. And the incentives are not good for fixing that. The negotiators on the U.S. side are the Commerce Department and the Federal Trade Commission. They have no authority over surveillance. They deal with commercial privacy, privacy when it comes to companies like Google and Facebook. And Europeans certainly care about that, too. And the negotiator on their side is the Commission, which is the regulatory body that basically gets everything rubber stamped through the Parliament, which is one of the reasons why some Brits decided to vote to leave, because it is this unaccountable rubber stamping regulatory body. They don't have authority over surveillance either. Surveillance is conducted by individual member states within the EU, and many of them don't want to address government surveillance. So it suits both the Obama administration, which doesn't want to deal with surveillance. They want to deal with commercial privacy. Same with the European Commission. It suits them both to pivot to, point the finger at Google and Facebook. Meanwhile, no one's resolving the issue that the European Court of Justice, which is basically their Supreme Court, they're talking about surveillance. So the incentives are all over the place. And of course, companies just want any type of agreement to go through, because then they can go back to business as usual until the next lawsuit comes. Right.
And the difference here isn't that politicians are fundamentally different on either side of the Atlantic, right? On both sides, you have people who try to kick the can down the road. I mean, they all have similar incentives to avoid dealing with difficult issues. The most important difference, though, is the courts in the U.S. play a critical role in forcing things to get resolved. They create some urgency. In a sense, they set a deadline. For example, the USA Freedom Act, a lot of the surveillance reforms that we've had, even ECPA reform, which is close to getting done, have either been done or are close to getting done because the courts have put some pressure on things. The Supreme Court has taken a number of very clear stances in recent decisions about the collection of data without a warrant, right? And in Europe, that's only starting to happen. Schrems may be the beginning of that kind of approach, but it's just very early days. It's like the European Union is dealing with 21st century technology, but they're still essentially figuring out the most basic parts of judicial review. Marbury versus Madison, fundamental Supreme Court case that started us on judicial review in the United States, that was 200 years ago plus. And that's something that Europe essentially is just now getting with Schrems. So it just works very differently. And there's also a cultural dimension to this, which is becoming much more clear to me because I've just started reading a book called Post-War, A History of Europe since 1945. It is a really good intellectual history, among other things, about the mentality of central planning. Tony Judt, the author, is very sympathetic to that. He's a Brit who writes in defense of the European model of social democracy. So the book is by no means a libertarian book, but it does very clearly explain how in the post-war consensus, essentially the war had demolished the concept of the liberal, i.e. libertarian state that was going to be a custodian that would just, the night watchman.
Yeah, because there was just too much work to be done, and the obvious person to do, or the obvious people to do it, were governments.
Well, and the idea generally was that there had been so many things had gone wrong in Europe for the previous three decades that the answer just had to be planning.
Yeah.
And that assumption has just has pervaded everything that has gone on in Europe since then. That's what the European Union fundamentally is about. And whatever else one might say about Brexit and the hostility towards immigration and a certain degree of stasis thinking that drove Brexit, at least in part, it's also a rebellion against that kind of top-down planning from Brussels.
Yeah, and let's talk about the implications for tech policy, because most of the coverage of Britain voting to leave the European Union has focused on demographics, which is very interesting. Obviously, the way that young people voted, radically different than old people. Scotland and Northern Ireland and London all voted to remain, whereas the rest of the country and rest of England, including Wales, decided to leave. Those were all interesting storylines. The anti-immigration thing might have been overplayed. As you say, there were some legitimate concerns about sovereignty that were really important too. But not much of the coverage has focused on tech, obviously, because tech is always a place second fiddle to things like the pound collapsing and global stock markets, newsworthy items. But let's talk about how it relates to tech. There's been some headlines saying it might be easier to get a privacy shield through without Britain, because Britain is one of the worst offenders when it comes to government surveillance. They don't have the basic oversight in many ways that the United States has, even if our oversight is toothless. Do you see any implications for tech policy and basically the nature of tech policy changing without Britain in the European Union?
Let's take privacy shield first, because I think there's two different ideas there. So the first idea is, remember, the Schrems decision sets a standard of essential equivalence. Now, it's not clear from the decision, does that mean essential that another country, the United States here, has to be essentially equivalent in order to be declared adequate for European privacy protection? Is that essential equivalence to the ideal of European privacy protection? Or is it, as I think is probably the case, is it to the reality of European privacy protection? And if it is to the reality, well, the reality is different in every single state.
Right.
So some states are better on national security. Some states are very bad on law enforcement. The Dutch, for example, who we think of as being very progressive, are very aggressive about using law enforcement or giving law enforcement access to private data in just run-of-the-mill investigations on a regular basis.
It might sound great if the Dutch intelligence authorities don't abuse surveillance, but if it's the local police department doing it, does it really matter when it comes to the consumer whether the abuse happens at the local or the federal level?
Right.
I mean, it might matter for in terms of the European Union, which probably deals more with government at the federal level than local law enforcement.
So one idea here is that, and you said this just a moment ago, that Britain, by pulling out, in some sense will kind of raise the average of European privacy protection. I'm not sure that's really true. I mean, the average is getting worse in Europe in general. It's worth noting that the French, for all of their harping about the Patriot Act and their attacks on the evil Bush administration, what was the very first thing that François Hollande did after the attacks in Paris? He declared a state of emergency and amended the Constitution to enable more aggressive surveillance. So, you know, Europe is clearly sliding back into the kind of surveillance mentality that so many Europeans criticized here in the United States. So who knows? But that's one idea. The second idea, and that the first one at least has some legal plausibility to it. The second one essentially has nothing to do with law and simply would confirm what I was saying a moment ago. It would just suggest that the European Court of Justice won't make a legal decision. It'll make a policy decision. And the thesis is this, that Brexit has been such a shock to Europe politically that the European Court of Justice would be more reluctant to strike down the privacy shield because it would call into question the ability of Europeans to work with or use American services, and it would be just another disruption. And all of those judges from each of the member states on the European Court of Justice are just going to hold back, even if they thought it was the right thing to do legally, they'll just hold back in practical terms because Europe just isn't ready for another big shock. Now, that's possible. I mean, it could be that that's really what drives the mentality over at the ECJ. But if that's true, then it's not a court. It's essentially just another legislature.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And there's another really important issue here that doesn't just affect tech. It affects the entire European Union and all sorts of industries, the role that Britain played at the table. So you've got competing visions of how to govern here. You mentioned France. France is very much a top-down country. Paris basically sets policy for the entire country. They're not federal the way that Germany is, divided up into states or even Canada, the United States, not very powerful local authorities. They're very much in line with the European view of the top-down, more planning will lead to better results. It's understandable given the history of World War II and the continent. The UK played more of a free market role, you know, aside from maybe Scotland and Northern Ireland. They sat at the table to say, you know what, more sovereignty, fewer regulations, things like that. That's a voice that won't be there anymore, an important voice. Germany might have to play that role doubly as hard as they normally do to counter people like France who might say, yep, Britain's gone, so let's go back to the whole top-down thing and let's be even more aggressive towards American tech companies. Let's be more aggressive about things like taxation and data localization and taxation through fines, which we talked about on our episode about the Google antitrust case. This could have a major effect on the tech sector just by not having that free market voice at the table.
Yeah, well, I want to just reiterate the caveat I made a few minutes ago about how it's really difficult for anybody outside of a cultural context to really to say exactly what's going on.
As two Americans wax about Europeans.
Yeah, although you were just in France.
And, yeah, I got a little bit of it, yeah.
So take this with a large amount of salt. Two things. So number one, Britain actually has a tech sector.
Spotify.
Spotify, I think, is Swedish.
No, it's UK, I think. Well, Swedish. All right. Thank you.
but anyway, the point is that when I asked in Helsinki about this, people said to me, yeah, probably about half of the European tech companies that are active and engaged and have some potential are based in London. I mean, London is the biggest European hub for tech. Of course, there's also Berlin,
yeah.
And there are companies in Ireland, there are companies everywhere.
Right.
But a lot of them were in and will probably remain in Britain for a variety of reasons, one of them simply being language. I mean, part of the reason that French, say, or German tech companies have a hard time developing is that you need scale. And it's a lot easier if your product, if the first version of it is in English, for that to work. But the point is that to the extent that a lot of European tech policy is driven by insecurity about not having those companies inside the team, that's just going to get worse because now Britain's going to be outside the European Union. There's going to be even more resentment and more of a tendency to crack down. So that's one effect. The second effect is Britain has played a moderating influence, both because it has more of a liberal tradition in our sense of the word.
Right.
And also because it has a better relationship with the United States. And so it's easier for American companies and American ideas and nonprofits and so on to be filtered through people in Britain. And now it's not clear how well that's going to work. And you mentioned Germany as another country that where that might work. And that's possible. I mean, Angela Merkel has said some very smart things about net neutrality regulation, for example. In some ways, because of her and influence from some more market-oriented parts of the European Union has taken a smarter position on the issue of paid prioritization, saying that, yeah, in some ways it can be good. There are some services, we've talked about online gaming on the show, that only really work if you can pay for priority.
Yeah, the EU has kind of tacitly rejected the notion that all bits are created equal, which is kind of a radical idea if you think about it, that you can't even rank the importance of internet services. Not everything can be equally important. Watching a cat video is not the same as performing surgery over FaceTime or something like that. Like, we have to be able to recognize that there are differences, and the European Union seems to have done that. And you're not going to get a lot of talk about that in the United States because, like you said, it's totally self-serving. When the EU takes a less aggressive approach to regulation, you know, our friends on the left will just ignore it because that helps our cause. But then on the other side of the pond, they'll say the FCC is validating everything that they're doing. So it's just a back and forth of basically cafeteria picking the things they do that confirm your biases and vice versa. Whereas I think that our Democrats in Washington and some of the left-wing think tanks in D.C. can learn a lot from the European approach to net neutrality about addressing core concerns that we can all get behind, but leaving open that door to an entire class of innovative services that Angela Merkel basically referred to as specialized services. Now, that's a perfect segue to the big news that happened while we were away, which was that this months-long problem of us thinking that a decision is going to happen on a Tuesday or Friday and not happening and really screwing with our scheduling. Of course, the FCC on purpose, because they knew that Barron and I were in Europe, decided to release the decision while we were away. So,
and in fact, on the very day when we had always thought it was most likely that the decision would come, which was the last Tuesday of the term.
Yeah. And so give us your thoughts. I mean, basically, it looks like the FCC kind of ran the table, at least in this round, right?
Yes and no. I mean, let's just be clear. So this was a panel of the DC Circuit that heard the first appeal of the 2015 Open Internet Order. There were three judges on the panel. Two of them essentially agreed with the FCC on everything. The third judge agreed with us on, in particular, the arguments that we at Tech Freedom had made as interveners.
Yeah, so we were actually involved in the case, which meant that the court had to address our arguments.
Right. And our core argument was that the FCC should not enjoy a deference under the 1984 decision of Chevron.
And where, what does that mean?
Well, when a statute is ambiguous, as most statutes might be in some respects,
right,
it's hard to write statutes that are not ambiguous. The Supreme Court has said, well, the Congress intended for that ambiguity to be resolved by the agency, and that it was better for that to be resolved by the agency than to be resolved by a court. The court should defer to the agency if the agency's interpretation is reasonable. As you can imagine, that has created an enormous amount of leeway for agencies to do whatever they want. So here, the underlying question was, is the definition of a telecom service ambiguous? And the FCC persuaded the DC Circuit that it was ambiguous and pointed to the Supreme Court's decision back in 2005 in Brand X. The FCC had said that cable modem service is an information service. That had not been clear previously. So in a way, that was the kind of the opposite of what the FCC did here. In other words, lowering the regulatory treatment, regulating down, deregulating, however you want to put it. Here, the FCC went in the opposite direction. And the court basically said, well, look, the statute is ambiguous. You can go whichever way you want. Up, down, whatever, it's up to you. You can change your mind as long as you provide some explanation. That provoked a very angry dissent from Judge Williams, senior judge, very respected judge, who agreed with us and said essentially that, fine, the FCC perhaps could justify reclassifying broadband as a Title II service, but they haven't provided an adequate basis to do so here. And the way their justification for doing it is arbitrary and capricious, in particular because at the same time that the FCC is saying in the Open Internet Order that broadband requires treatment as a common carrier under Title II, that at the same time the FCC is going to forbear from imposing the rest of Title II. And Judge Williams says that's inherently inconsistent. You can't, or at least you haven't explained how you can say that broadband requires this aggressive treatment on the one hand, and then at the same time, for the first time ever, really, forbear from regulating them without really doing any analysis of the market, which I just want to, this is really important. For people who think that the FCC won a great victory and that this is great for net neutrality and ensures that the FCC will always be a cop on the beat, the most important thing for them to understand is just even if the FCC wins, which is not on review, which is not clear that they will, but if they do, future FCC, Republican FCC, could use this decision to undo everything in the order through forbearance and basically everything else in the act, because the court granted the FCC such sweeping discretion to change its mind, to forbear from more regulation or to unforbear from the parts where the FCC actually held back here and didn't go full bore on Title II. So my bottom line is that if this decision stands, it basically means that internet regulation is going to be a game of ping pong, where the courts are going to be sitting on the sidelines, just watching the ball go back and forth from election to election.
Yeah, and the basic idea is that if forbearance is needed to prevent some of the outdated and inapplicable, as the FCC sees it, parts of the law, then why not just basically write a rule that is everything but the things you're forbearing from? It kind of, to the casual listener, they might just say, Why are you invoking this massive set of regulations and then saying, but we're only going to take these parts? Just start with those parts. Like, if they're going to do whatever they want anyway, it seems like they're just retaining the authority to have it so that they can then use it down the line. And of course, it's a Pyrrhic victory because any Republican administration that disagrees with this could just say, nope, the record has changed, and now the facts have changed and the meanings of words have changed, and we're just going to undo everything through forbearance. So it's kind of crazy to think that Congress can pass a law, an agency can then look at that law and say, I want this and this, but I'm going to leave that. And this is a la carte policymaking. It seems kind of ridiculous. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. So basically, let's lay out for listeners what's going to happen, because every headline said net neutrality wins across the board, the FCC wins. Thank God we're now going to have freedom of speech and all these other things that were obviously threatened and needed regulation to prevent them from happening. What's next? There was three judges. This is not over. There's going to be appeals. Can you kind of lay out where this is going?
So there are two things that will happen next. We have 45 days from the decision, which is to say until July 29th, to file our petitions for en banc review, which is to ask the full D.C. Circuit to rehear the case.
So there were three judges initially, and how many would be the full?
So it'll be 11, I believe. It's a little complicated because the rules are that all of the judges sit on the en banc panel, except the senior judges. And that's important politically because D.C. Circuit used to be a bastion of Republican appointees who were very skeptical of administrative agencies. That's changed in the last 9 years, 7 years. One, because the Obama administration has put three new judges on the court, and also because some Republicans have taken senior status. So the balance of the power on the court has shifted significantly. But the catch is that Judge Williams, because he sat on the panel, he gets to sit in the en banc review. So you get another Republican. And Chief Judge Merrick Garland, who's been nominated to the Supreme Court, has recused himself from any further active cases at the court. So what that means is that instead of having a 7-4 Democrat to Republican panel, you end up getting a 6-5 Democrat to Republican panel.
So
it's a lot more
balance.
That's right. And frankly, I don't think the issues here are partisan. I mean, I think that if you look at this case objectively, you understand that the real issue is not net neutrality. It's how much authority does the FCC in particular, and do administrative agencies in general, have to change their mind, reinterpret statutes, do whatever they want. That cuts both ways. That could, as I said before, that could allow a Republican FCC in the future to gut regulation, or it could allow this FCC to invent this weird hodgepodge in the middle where they're basically rewriting the act. They essentially say, we know that Title II would be a terrible fit for broadband, so we're not going to impose all of Title II. We're going to invent this new kind of Title II light, and that's what we're going to impose on the FCC. And our argument and our briefs essentially goes to that specific issue, which Judge Williams did pick up on in his dissent, saying essentially, look, if Chevron means anything, it means it does have limits. And Supreme Court has been starting to carve cases out from Chevron, saying some cases like Obamacare, court just declined to apply Chevron. Even though they upheld the law, they analyzed the Obamacare statute afresh. And then similarly, we point to another Supreme Court decision from 2014, where the court said, look, if you're essentially rewriting the law and you acknowledge that what you're doing wouldn't be a fit with the original intent of Congress, that may be another indication that Chevron shouldn't apply. And here, the fact that the FCC does have a forbearance power doesn't change that analysis, because it's not a permanent rewriting of the statute. It's a way of saying we're just not going to apply the following provisions for a certain amount of time. But the underlying point still stands. The FCC recognized that Title II wasn't a good fit and then created this new modernized, quote, tailored version of Title II. And that's what we're objecting to. So that's the first thing that'll happen. Petitions for en banc review. We'll make those arguments. We'll focus on Judge Williams, who really accepted a great deal of what we had to say. That may or may not get accepted. The court doesn't have to rehear the case. It doesn't happen very often. But we think we have a pretty good shot at getting the case reheard. If it does, the whole thing will just go through another round of argument and briefing, and probably we'll have arguments in the fall, and a decision would probably come out, I had to guess, I would say probably again in June of next year. That is option number one. Option number two is going to the Supreme Court. If the D.C. Circuit declines to rehear the case, there's a three-month deadline for filing those petitions to the court for review. The court, again, doesn't have to hear the case, but if they do, the big question is going to be about timing. And specifically, do they get another judge, a justice, on the court in time to hear the case? If they don't, if it's 4-4, then if the court deadlocks, the underlying D.C. Circuit decision will stand.
Right, and certainly the death of Justice Scalia completely threw that question into flux, because if it's a 4-4 decision, like you say, then the lower court ruling stands. And this issue goes beyond internet policy. If you care about other areas of the economy, other industries, other types of regulation, the idea that an agency can just pick and choose, rewrite the meanings of words, and do all these things that the FCC has done, that's problematic for any industry. So really this idea that ambiguity equals boundless authority, we might want to take a look at that. There is a bill in Congress that might be coming out, I think, next week that is dealing with Chevron deference. And we really need to ask ourselves, is Congress doing a shitty job of writing laws, justification for unelected bureaucrats to do whatever they want? Or should it be that when Congress writes a shitty law that is unclear, they just have to rewrite the damn law?
Well, okay, so the bill you reference is the Separation of Powers Act, SOPRA. And that's really, the title is key, because that is the core issue here, is are we going to allow the executive branch or independent agencies created by Congress to essentially craft law willy-nilly, or are the courts going to play some role in saying that those decisions should be left up to Congress, ultimately? And you mentioned Justice Scalia. He was really a mixed bag on this, and both sides of the Open Internet Order case invoke him. The other side says, look, Justice Scalia defended Chevron, which is true. He, for many years, said that if we the courts get into the business of trying to figure out what is the best reading of a statute, that the courts will become too activist, and that they'll be taking too much power from the legislatures. And if the legislature doesn't like what the courts are doing, that the legislature can solve the problem. That generally was his view. They also say, well, he was in favor of Title II treatment for broadband, right? Now, under the specific fact pattern of the Brand X case, that's true. He wrote a dissent saying that he thought that there was a better reading of the statute. But we would actually cite the most recent version of Justice Scalia, where back in that case I mentioned from 2014, which was called UARG, he said there were limits to Chevron. Even if he was willing to apply Chevron vigorously when it applied, he also said that there were times when, because of the separation of powers, the courts needed to draw a line and to say that some things that agencies do are essentially intruding on the discretion of the legislature to make essentially legislative decisions.
Yeah, and it's basically become what many skeptics of government regulation call the fourth branch. You know, there's the fourth branch in the sense that the news media play that role, but there's really the fourth branch of government becoming the regulatory apparatus of the executive, but doing things that the executive traditionally would not be able to do unilaterally with the president, maybe with executive orders. It's really the executive doing Congress's work for it. And the incentives suck here, because a lot of congressmen are happy to let the FCC do stupid things and then complain about it in fundraising emails, rather than hiring the staff that are necessary to get a bill to fix it. And the incentives for a president are to cement his legacy, maybe. And he, you know, some people have, the president himself at a White House correspondents dinner joked that he's in the F it stage of his presidency, where he'll just do whatever, whether it's executive action on immigration, and the courts either strike me down or I'll just keep going. And there's not really the incentive for Democrats to do something about this, for Republicans to do something about this. Everyone in Congress is incentivized to raise money. They don't necessarily have staff that are capable of doing telecom work, so they're happy to cede everything to the FCC and either praise the agency or complain about the agency, and no one's doing the job of legislating. And that's why it's increasingly falling to the administrative state, which is not great for people in the United States, because you can't hold them accountable other than who the president happens to pick to chair an agency.
And this is the flip side of what we were talking about at the beginning of the show about Europe. Because here, and part of the reason that this happens is because both the administration and the legislature can just kind of kick back and say, well, the courts will sort it out. Like we can wait and see. That doesn't happen in Europe. So in a perverse way, one of the advantages of the European model, especially in parliamentary governments, is that the government can do what it wants. I mean, the legislature, if you win a mandate, like especially in Britain, but this is true in Germany and other systems as well, you can more or less do whatever you want. You don't necessarily have to deal with a lot of constraints from the courts. And so you've got to come up with something that is workable and you're held accountable for it.
You could easily lose your entire majority in a matter of 2 years. We've seen that happen where a party gets elected, they form a coalition, they rubber stamp everything through, and then it doesn't work out. And all of those people are gone. And I mean all of them. Like you can see large swaths of incumbents in European governments just gone, dissolved completely, which is a different system. And of course, there are pros and cons. Now, we've probably gone a little bit over time, but any parting thoughts about Europe, America, net neutrality, the art of podcasting? This is our 100th episode, as I've now mentioned a couple of times.
Well, on the podcast, Evan, I tease you a lot, but here goes. You know, from all of our listeners, I would say I think you're doing a great job. I couldn't be happier with the show. Our goal for the next 100 episodes is to get a wider range of people on the show. I mean, part of the reason that we started this, as you well know, is to give a voice to people who have a lot to say about tech policy that don't necessarily have a forum to do it. There are lots of events here in Washington where you can hear smart people talk about things, but you have to be here, or you have to be willing to sit and watch a live stream.
Or there's other panelists there to interrupt them.
Yeah, it's a different format. It's longer. I mean, the point is, We're trying to really pick and choose the best of the tech policy world, both in DC and in Europe and elsewhere, and bring them to listeners in shorter form.
And thank you for those who've provided feedback. It has helped. We decided, as you might have noticed over the past couple of weeks, to not do 5 per week. I know that was overwhelming for many of you who want to listen to every single episode.
So now we're doing 7, right?
Yeah, which was a nice surprise to me that there are people who actually want to listen to every episode, regardless of the topic, because we do a wide range of topics. And I know that there's been a call for more debates. I guess Baron and I don't disagree often enough on policy, just basic things like, you know, office procedures and you know, whether or not I have a job.
Exactly.
Those are things we tend to disagree about. But yeah, we're going to work on getting more debates. It's obviously a scheduling hassle, but we're going to get it done. We'll have more 3-person episodes where someone can disagree with Baron so that I don't just confirm everything he says so that he doesn't fire me, because maybe that's what's happening. I don't know.
We're also going to reduce Jared to appearing maybe only one in every like 3 episodes.
Yes, Jared, now, especially now that I live next to him, it's become just way too easy. But I do want to thank all those who helped to make this podcast possible. It isn't just me. I know it's easy to assume that because I am great, but there are other people who do this as well. Baron is occasionally a guest, much to my dismay. So thank Baron for providing time to be interviewed and harassed on the show. I'd like to thank Dan Reynolds, our full-time editor, who's actually in the room right now to hear us make mistakes.
But he doesn't have a mic, so yeah, he can't say anything.
It's easier to edit when he watches us make dumb errors.
And he's fixed the problem you may have noticed in the past that we've had about people talking over each other, which now means we'll have a lot more people talking over each other on the show, which it will make it a lot more natural.
And like the O'Reilly factor.
And no, but it'll make it easier to do debates and to have, you know, a give and take on the show instead of I talk, and then you talk, and then I talk, and that's not the way conversation actually works.
I'd also like to thank Josh Evans, our excellent communications coordinator, who helps me prepare for the show by researching the topics.
And writing all of our jokes.
Yeah, writing all of our jokes, putting together a roadmap for discussion, and he and Dan Benavente also edit the show, and our intern Annalise has been proactive lately about booking guests, so we've got a lot of great people working to make this the number one podcast in the world, according to us. So thank you all for listening.
In the rarefied category of tech policy podcast.
Yes. My guest has been the next Prime Minister for Great Britain, Baron Soka. Baron, thank you so much for joining the show.
Happy to remain. Or leave for today.
Well, I might be leaving permanently, but we'll see what happens.
That would be an Evan Nixit?
that really doesn't work. Let us know what you think of the show at media@techfreedom.org.
It's almost evanescent.
Congratulate us for 100 episodes. We need to hear it. We need that validation to keep going. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Leave a review for us in the iTunes store because it will help others find the show. And thanks for listening.
The Tech Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.